Ryan Means, all the way from Chicago. We are taking on this.
My name is Ryan Mead. I teach at Loyola University Chicago. I teach in the law school. So I come at philosophy from a little bit of a different angle. And excuse me a little bit, I'm under the weather. My voice has gone in and out the past couple of days. At the moment, it's in. So if it goes out, please forgive me. So I'll start. First, thank you for the opportunity to present this paper today. I regretted not being able to come to member weekends in the past since I joined the society a few years ago, so I'm delighted to be here now. And I imagine this happens every day or every year, but I must join in what's likely a common course in thanking Marianne for her efforts in promoting philosophy on the internet. That's how I ended up joining the society, and also thank Oxford for fulfilling its ancient role as a center for learning, particularly lifelong learning. Even when you're in Chicago, you can utilize the resources of Oxford. So, thought experiments are sometimes viewed by philosophers as their own little treasure, complete with a sizable body of literature exploring their usefulness, trying to categorize them, refining what makes a good thought experiment or not. And only begrudgingly do some people admit that thought experiments can be borrowed by scientists. And then only the really big ones can do thought experiments properly. Galileo and Einstein have been accepted into the Thought Experiment Hall of Fame. This is a provocative exaggeration, of course, which most philosophers would deny. But it's hard not to pick up on this tone when reading through the literature on thought experiments. If you scan the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy's entry for thought experiments, you quickly get bogged down in the array of taxonomies that have tried to group thought experiments. The article in the Stanford Encyclopedia is a good illustration of trying to explore purist thought experiments versus heterodox thought experiments. The Stanford entry is a bewildering exercise in attempting to establish an orthodoxy on thought experiments, though never quite settling on one. These discussions of thought experiments seem to grossly overcomplicate things. Though perhaps this is not surprising for a body of thinkers who can't even agree on whether their lunch exists. Most people don't argue over whether their lunch exists, and most people do not have trouble grasping what thought experiment is. I am going to propose a very simple definition of a thought experiment. A thought experiment is a considered imaginary case. When considering imaginary cases, there are many things we can do with them. We can explore conclusions that flow from the imaginary case. We can contrast the case with something that has happened or does happen in the course of events. Or we could test a hypothesis with the imaginary case. No doubt there are many things we could do with the imaginary case, but at core, the action of considering an imaginary case involves using reasoning to explore something that has not happened. I have three parts to my paper. Part one will explore more of my definition of a thought experiment, and I will also set out three common features I find in thought experiments. There are more common features than these three, but I will limit my remarks to three. Part two of my paper will discuss how thought experiments are everyday occurrences. They are part of ordinary human reasoning and a part of decision making, at least as I define a thought experiment. Finally, part three of this paper will briefly explore the use of thought experiments outside of philosophy and science, with particular attention to my own area in law and how thought experiments, how thought experiments are used in training lawyers. This talk is meant to set the stage for later discussion. These three parts are only loosely connected. And I wish to emphasize that. I am not proposing a definitive discourse on thought experiments, but providing a launching pad for the weekend. Personally, I would be interested in any additional common features that we can come up with on thought experiments beyond my three, or perhaps as the weekend progresses, we could keep a tally of consensus common points. I may then expand beyond my three for my published paper. Or perhaps no one will agree on my three, let alone the existence of our lunch tomorrow. For the record, I'm a realist and I do believe that my lunch exists. So part one, a proposed definition. First, back to my definition of a thought experiment, a considered imaginary case. What do I mean by imaginary and what do I mean by case? I'll start with case. By case, I mean a set of facts and descriptors. Some literature on thought experiments debate what level of detail of facts are needed for an adequate thought experiment. The level of detail seems irrelevant to me. As long as there are sufficient facts to grapple with the case, then there are enough facts to have a thought experiment. One of the most famous contemporary thought experiments is, what is it like to be a bat? But it contains almost no facts. It asks the engager to explore the subjective experience of a bat. Two facts, a bat and the subjectivity of the bat. If you are inclined to one school of bat hylomorphism, then maybe there is only one fact, the unitary bat. By imaginary, I mean that the case has not occurred, but it is proposed conceptually. Some people might say that something imaginary is only in your head, but I believe this takes us down a road of philosophy of mind and philosophy of language that we needn't go. If we could all agree that imaginary means that the facts have not occurred, that we have thought up the facts, and the facts are dealt with notionally and conceptually, then that should be sufficient for what I mean by imaginary. Importantly, by imaginary, I do not mean to suggest that a thought experiment needs to be fanciful or exotic. Philosophers like to deal with exotic thought experiments because exotic thought experiments leave an impression and are sometimes better able to allow the thinker to draw sharp consequences, comparisons, and firmer conclusions. What is it like to be a bat? It's not really about what it's like to be a bat. It ends up being about self-consciousness and human self-consciousness. I rank zombies, brains, and bats, and splitting amoeba persons in the realm of fanciful and exotic, but they are not the thought experiments that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, simply as humans. Now, in order to have a thought experiment, we need more than just imagination and facts. We need to do something with the imaginary case. After all, a fairy tale is an imaginary case. So is a novel. A novel is an imaginary case. A story is an imaginary case. But these aren't necessarily thought experiments. Novels may teach and tell a story, but they don't seem to be thought experiments as we typically use that term. So what does a person do with a thought experiment? This is a minefield because already in raising the specter of a novel, we might be able to wonder whether it is a borderline thought experiment. Some novels, particularly those with a philosophical bent, may prove to verge on thought experiments. But I will set those aside for now. The literature disagrees on what a person does with an imaginary case in order to render it a thought experiment, but there are some areas of consensus. Some of these actions where there is consensus include being able to illustrate and defend a theory, that is, using the imaginary case to illustrate and defend your theory of something, using the imaginary case to critique and poke holes in a theory, or to make plausible a theory, or to push a theory to its limits. There seems to be some agreement on these uses, but there are disagreements over whether thought experiments can be used to test intuition, and even whether ethics properly uses thought experiments. Yet again, I think the literature is making things a bit too difficult as to what we need to do with imaginary cases in order for something to be a thought experiment. Doesn't simply thinking through an imaginary case suffice? To explore what a person does with an imaginary case in order to do a thought experiment, to think through an imaginary case, I would like to go back to looking at what any experiment is. We'll offer my own simplified definition for an experiment. An experiment is an action that involves recording observations from the action and starts with a question about the action that is to be observed. Most basically, an experiment asks, what if P? Where P is some state of affairs in which we wonder about. Or, as is more likely with physical experiments, what happens when I do X? The normal course of a physical experiment involves actually doing X and seeing what happens. Sometimes X is done because we hypothesize that when we do X, then Y will happen. Or sometimes we do the physical experiment that we are doing just to see what happens when we do X. But the important point in a physical experiment is that X is done and whatever happens is observed. This is an experiment. It may be done once or it may be done multiple times. But at base, we are asking this question, what happens when I do X? Expanding on from this, a thought experiment is done speculatively and not physically. The thought experiment still takes shape something like what happens when I do X. It's just that I am not going to do X, but I'm going to think through doing X. To be sure, what happens when I do X is just a starting point question. Thought experiments might take on a variety of different forms of what if P. It might be suppose P, imagine P, assume P. I would suggest that all of our thought experiments this weekend could be put in the form of what if P. What if we all had a box containing something we all call a beetle, but none of us knew what was in each other's boxes? What if you and your friend use the same data, but you predict the next emerald will be green, and she predicts the next emerald will be blue? What if we encountered something that looks and tastes like water and has the chemical composition of water, but isn't water? What if the ship were slowly replaced plank by plank? Would it still be the same ship? What if we could save three people by pushing a man in front of a trolley? So if you're not comfortable with the three-word definition for a thought experiment, then I could expand my definition a bit to a set of facts that had not happened, about which we think through the implications and meaning of that set of facts. As for me, I'm going to stick with the thought experiment being a considered imaginary case. Along the way, in thinking through this definition, developing this working definition, I would say, there are three items which struck me that all thought experiments have. There are likely many more, but I will focus on three. One, a thought experiment is in the subjunctive. Two, a thought experiment uses no new data. Three, a thought experiment relies exclusively on the buildup of experiences and principles. This last feature will play heavily into the third part of my paper on the use of thought experiments in education. But let's take a quick look at each of these three. And I will use a fairly simple thought experiment that can be replicated as a physical experiment, but I have never tried it. For my what if P, I will use, what does a banana and avocado sandwich taste like? First, a thought experiment is in the subjunctive. The subjunctive denotes that a state of affairs is possible or contingent, but has not happened. This is an essential characteristic of a thought experiment. It can't have happened yet. If it has happened, then it is a physical experiment. A thought experiment might even be probable to occur. A thought experiment might not even be probable to occur and will never happen. But putting that aside, the importance is it has not happened. I have never eaten avocados and bananas together. Perhaps some of you have. I like bananas and I like avocados. They are both pleasant to me. Eating them is possible, but I've never tried doing it. In the thought experiment on my banana and avocado sandwich, I will think through doing this eating. Second, a thought experiment uses no new data. New data assumes a physical experiment or some physical thing. What happens when we do X? X has happened. We haven't had X happening in the thought experiment. In the physical experiment, data are produced, the results are observed and recorded. In the context of the form of what if P, when P happens, the first thing I do is record what happens when I engender that state of affairs, P. I record whatever happens. Perhaps later I will try to connect the dots and figure out why it happened. For example, in the physical realm of experimentation, when I eat bananas and avocados together, at first I am not going to use any logical reason. I'm merely going to experience the taste of bananas and avocados. I will record whether it is pleasant or not, whether the banana dominates the avocado or vice versa, whether the two individual tastes are still identifiable, or whether a third brand new taste is experienced. I will record data. When I engage in the thought experiment about eating bananas and avocados together, I do not have new data. I do not experience eating them together. The eating them together, which produces data, does not happen. I realize the second factor about no new data may be somewhat controversial, because a person could say, switching thought experiments, what if two amoeba people joined two other amoeba people for lunch? I've never met an amoeba person. It seems the literature is filled with amoeba people about thought experiments. But I could imagine that this grouping of amoeba people, two groups of two, constitutes four amoeba people. is 4 a new datum? Or is 4 assumed already in the facts about two groups of two amoeba people? I'm still wrestling with how math and thought experiments interact and need to leave this one for later. Point, though, in the second item is that no new data in the thought experiment, which hasn't happened yet, as I think through, no new data occurs. Which leads me to my third common feature. A thought experiment uses existing experiences and principles. The thought experiment uses what a person already has stored. The toolbox for considering an imaginary case is what you have experienced up to the point of considering the imaginary case. Then you use your toolbox, you use reasoning skills with your experiences and principles. Implied in this statement about using existing experience and principles is that reasoning does not produce new data, that a conclusion is not data, even though we have not conceptualized the conclusion before. The reasoning process is essential to a thought experiment. If we were only to use what we have stored up, then we wouldn't have thought experiments. I know what a bat is, and I have experienced subjectivity, stipulating, of course, that there is subjectivity in some type of self. Those two items, bat and subjectivity, are not enough to grapple with the question, what is it like to be a bat? I need to do something with these two facts. To answer the question, what is it like to be a bat? I need to reason and make distinctions. I need to compare my experience of being non-winged with what I speculate it might be like to be winged, to compare how I navigate the world principally with my eyesight versus navigating the world with something like sounds. I need to figure out what it's like to sleep horizontally versus the speculation of sleeping upside down, and what it is like to be permanently human versus what it is like to morph back and forth from bat to undead vampire. Maybe that's only a subset of bats. I'm not quite sure what type of bat Thomas Nagel is thinking of. But when I undertake the thought experiment, what is it like to be a bat? I have never been a bat before, so I can only speculate on what I know and have experienced. I have to speculate from an anthropomorphic perspective. That's the point of that thought experiment. Actually, I learn more about my anthropomorphic perspective. But not having been a bat doesn't stop me from speculating about being a bat. Never having seen an amoeba person does not stop me from speculating what happens when 4 of them get together for lunch. Likewise, with my bananas and avocado sandwich thought experiment, I can only speculate based on my experiences of eating bananas, my experiences of eating avocados, and also using my experiences of eating sandwiches that have seemingly odd ingredients paired together. While I do not know what an avocado and banana sandwich tastes like, and I never will until I try it, I can reason through some speculations, and perhaps most importantly, learn more than just the immediate question of what the avocado and banana might taste together, even though I'm only using my existing principles and experiences. The point, this last point of what else I will learn in thinking through the thought experiment using my existing principles and experience is going to be important in the third part on using thought experiments in education. Now, part 2, thought experiments are everyday occurrences. I would like to propose that everyone engages in thought experiments every day. If a thought experiment is a considered imaginary case, then we can see quickly that they are used in the social sciences, politics, law, ethics, just about every human field, even cooking, especially putting together odd sandwiches. Thought experiments have been with us as long as speculative reasoning has existed. Whenever someone thinks through what if P, the person is engaged in a thought experiment. So anytime we explore in our mind what happens when we do X, we are engaging in a type of thought experiment. Now, I recognize that I have a fairly broad definition of what a thought experiment is, and we might have some disagreements on that. I will give you an imaginary case I considered this morning. And I don't mean imaginary in that it's not possible. This is an imaginary case that I thought about, that I thought through, That really did happen, and I changed my talk at the last minute. I brought two ties with me in my luggage, a red one and a blue one. This morning I thought to myself, what will be my appearance if I wear the red tie? Now, it turns out that the red tie I packed is very bright. It's new and I've never worn it before. It looked a lot brighter this morning than I remembered when I packed it the other day. I tried to think through what it would be like to be here wearing a bright red tie today. The implications of this thought experiment were not good. I might look garish and odd. I might look a little too American. How do British people respond to loud, flashy ties? Actually, looking around, I probably should have thought about whether to wear a tie. In any case, I might feel uncomfortable and self-conscious wearing the loud, garish tie. The risks were too high in wearing the red tie. I then imagined myself wearing my blue tie, and I thought, what will be my appearance if I wear the blue tie? This time, the experience showed a subtler appearance and not an image in which I would feel self-conscious, and this satisfied me. This thought experiment had a practical impact. I chose the blue tie. I'm not going to wear a tie tomorrow. I didn't try on either tie, and I didn't spend the day collecting data on whether the red tie felt better to me than the blue tie, nor did I go about the day switching back and forth and trying to compare the data. I didn't even try to tie on. I just thought about it. I thought through this imaginary case this morning and came to a conclusion. Now, not all thought experiments lead to physical action. Wondering what it is like to be a bat doesn't make me go out and attempt transspeciesism to become a bat. But the most frequent thought experiments we engage in help us make practical choices. My red tie thought experiment seems just as valid a thought experiment as the trolley problem, though more serious questions are at stake in the trolley problem than my tie quandary. What if I wore the bright red tie? Practical thought experiments are often mundane because they deal with the need to think through activities that we can do. They have possible premises. We play out subjunctive scenarios before we make decisions we have never made before. We play out subjunctive scenarios using principles and experiences we already have and apply new facts and circumstances to the potential that we think through. Long before the thought experiment was named in the 19th century, thought experiments became part of what we do as humans. But let's face it, we're here this weekend to grapple with fanciful and colorful and exotic thought experiments. Is there much more fun than thinking through whether to wear a red tie or a blue tie? Part 3, using thought experiments in education. In this last part of my paper, I would like to discuss how I use thought experiments in education. As I mentioned at the beginning, I teach law in Chicago. Although the UK, particularly England, and the US share a base legal system, a common law system, and common law opinions of judges are valid precedent in both countries, we have very different legal education systems. In the UK, law is studied principally on an undergraduate basis and then involves training after graduation. Whereas in the United States, law is exclusively a postgraduate doctoral program, and the method of teaching is quite different. The 3 years of postgraduate law school in the US are divided in two, between the first year and the second and third year. The second and third year are typical lecture courses and completion of writing obligations. But the first year is taught almost exclusively through the use of thought experiments, though we refer to these as hypotheticals or hypos. Here's what happens. Each night, a student is assigned to read a case and outline a variety of aspects of the case. This is called briefing. This briefing includes outlining the facts of the case, the conclusions of the judge, and the reasoning the judge used to reach the conclusion. The principal holding of the case, a holding is the part of the case that has precedential value for the next case that comes down the line, the principal holding of the case is to be identified by the student. It's not always obvious when you read the case what the holding is. It's a difficult thing to grasp this. So trying to outline this, finding the holding, that's just the start. And the student prepares in this way. The next day during class, the student is called on. Students are called on randomly. You don't know whether you're going to be called on that day. The professor asks the student to recite the briefing. So the student recites the facts, identifies the conclusion, and goes through the reasoning process that the judge uses to reach the conclusion. The professor takes the facts a little bit, challenges the student to make sure that the student is understanding the facts and has identified the holding. But that is just where the professor starts. There's a whole lot more that happens the rest of the hour. The professor takes the facts of the case that's been studied the night before and changes them, usually just a little bit. If the facts changed a little bit, then how would the holding of the case apply to the new facts? What if the facts were such and such? What would the likely outcome of the case have been? Now, if the facts changed not just a little, but changed a lot, then what would the likely outcome of the case have been there? None of these changes are real cases. All of these are permutations, hypotheticals, thought experiments, if you will. I'll give you an example of a case, very simple, and then how professors use this case to train the lawyers, the young lawyers. Suppose in a case John trespassed on Henry's property and destroyed Henry's tomato plants. The court concludes that Henry is liable to John for the value of the tomatoes. The court assigns a value of $5 to the tomatoes and requires John to pay Henry $5. The holding in this case is that a trespasser must pay the property owner for any damage caused by his trespass. Easy enough, and quite an ancient legal principle. But now, where do the thought experiments come in the education? We take the facts and we change them a bit. What if it was dark out and John thought he was going onto his own property and not Henry's? Is there trespass? What if, due to darkness, John did not know that he destroyed Henry's tomatoes? Does John still owe Henry the value of the tomatoes? What if the tomatoes were rotten and could not be eaten? Would they have any value, and would John owe Henry anything, even though John had trespassed and destroyed tomatoes? Although they're rotten tomatoes. What if the tomatoes from Henry's garden had year after year been awarded the best prize at the Chelsea Tomato Show? What value would John owe Henry? Would it be more than the $5? Would it be less than the $5? What if John always used a pseudonym at the Chelsea Tomato Show and none of his neighbors knew the tomatoes in his garden were highly valuable, award-winning tomatoes? What if John knew about Henry's prizes and was jealous and intentionally destroyed the tomatoes out of rage? Should John pay more money? What if Henry's wife forced John at gunpoint to destroy John's tomatoes? What if John was forced at gunpoint by his wife to destroy the tomatoes, but John secretly delighted in the destruction of the tomatoes? He still owed the $5. The permutations are nearly endless. The what-ifs could go on for quite a long time. Unfortunately for the student tackling the case, these what-ifs and the questions do go on for quite a long time, but no longer than 1 hour. There are multiple purposes in this approach to legal education, but I will set out, and in conclusion, this part, I will set out two purposes that are in keeping with what I believe we are doing this weekend. One, the legal education thought experiments explore the limits of the holding of the case. At some point, the facts will so diverge from the circumstances of the original case that the holding cannot be applied to the thought experiment. The thought experiment, the case will have no logical application to the professor's eventual permutations. When the holding can no longer be applied to the professor's thought experiment that he or she is proposing to the student, then the edge of the case, or the edge of the legal principle, has been identified. In questioning the student often doesn't realize he or she has gone too far and tries to answer the question, tries to apply the facts. It's the professor's obligation at that point to point out to the student that the student has erred and has gone too far. But at that point, we've reached the edge, and the student remembers that. We're a lot more humane than when I went to law school, where you were usually belittled when you reached that edge. The student learns quite a bit from this single case. And oftentimes, a single case is used for an entire hour with one student. But a single case can illumine all of the situations. Figuring out that where the case ceases to have value is the central goal of this method. This helps the student understand the underlying principle in the case, and it sets the limit of the principle. Number two, the legal education thought experiments train the student in critical reasoning skills. The thought experiments, which are variation on the case's facts, invite the student to apply the principles of the case to new facts. The student has no idea how a court might rule on those facts, but the student needs to follow the application of the principle in the known case to the adjusted facts to see where the application leads. The application may show that the legal principle from the case is in fact able to enlighten the legal relationship in the revised facts, or it might show that the application leads to absurdity or something else that runs afoul of morals or other laws. While it is important that the student remember the case, the training of the student's mind is far more important than the specific facts of the case studied on any given day. The final exams and the final tests almost never test the student's memory of the case. They test the student's critical reasoning skills. The ability to apply principles to scenarios the student has never seen before, the ability to follow an argument to a conclusion, the ability to pressure test premises, the ability to make nuanced distinctions are all more important than what happens in any particular case. And that's how we use thought experiments in legal education. Using hypotheticals or thought experiments is not something unique to legal education. This is, of course, a similar way to how philosophers are trained to explore nuances and distinctions. There's a degree to which this approach is also used in medicine to make distinctions and differentiations, to rule out diseases, and ultimately infer a diagnosis. And of course, in moral education and ethical theory, the case method is also quite common. This is how thought experiments are usually used formally in education. Now, we didn't even dwell solely on the formal uses of thought experiments to see the value of thought experiments. The use of thought experiments is replete throughout our life in the normal course of decision making. We use them every day, whether they're used formally or informally. Now, it's usual to have a conclusion to a paper, and I would downgrade my students if they didn't make a conclusion, but I'm going to depart from that and just stop here, since my goal in this talk was just to set the stage and to set out these three loosely connected ideas to reflect on over the weekend and with our other thought experiments. So with that, let us set out the next 2 days to consider some imaginary cases. Thank you. Questions or objections, please? Yes.
You said that, in an aside, you said that the thought experiment or the circumstances of the thought experiment do not necessarily have to be within the realm of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very important point.
Yes.
But you also said that it does not introduce new data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me that if you go outside the realm of possibility, you introduce new data.
Mm-hmm.
I take, for example, up in the Turing Worlds hypothetical. Even what is it like to be a bat? They introduce impossibilities which become data that has to be accepted before one can begin to think of this thought experiment. And a lot of people balk at that at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so I think at least how I'm using it, I'm thinking that the conclusions or the thinking through the thought experiment doesn't produce new data. The thought experiment, particularly with fanciful and exotic thought experiments, is introducing new data that I haven't experienced. But I would say they're introducing those as premises. So there are premises that I'm going to have to assume in order to think through them. But along the way of thinking through them, unlike a physical experiment, I'm not producing anything new empirically. That's what I was thinking about it.
We can pursue this later.
Okay, sure, no problem. Yes,
sir. You said that the thought experiment, it must have been imaginary and mustn't have happened. So can I test that with a thought experiment?
Mm-hmm.
Professor Gray in law is used to using the kind of examples you've given us. In fact, he uses John and Henry and the trespass and the tomato case, and has done for some time. And the extension that he gives it in class has customarily been, now suppose that it turned out that the tomatoes, trespass, that were broken were not in fact Henry's, but Philip's.
Mm-hmm.
Expand on the holding, etc., in the belief that this has never been actually tried.
Mm-hmm.
And he does this for several years, but then some old law book turns up, and it turns out that in fact precisely a similar case, apart from the names, mm-hmm. has been tried. Nevertheless, Professor Gray thinks, well, it'll be a year before this appears in the journals. I can use it for another year. So, was it a proper thought experiment before he knew that it had really happened? And when he used it after he knew that it really happened, was it still a thought experiment?
That's a very good question. I'll take the last one first, and perhaps I'll answer as a lawyer rather than a philosopher. So, in that... It would be a real case, so it would not be a hypothetical or a thought experiment. He would have withheld those facts from the students. I suppose if you don't know that it's occurred, and you are imagining it, and you're thinking through it in that way, I suppose that counts as a thought experiment under my definition. If you find out it really has occurred, perhaps I forgot that I had a banana and avocado sandwich, and I recall it later. Well, then I suppose that I no longer have a thought experiment, but I would be reflecting on my experiences and trying to record up here some way, or recalling in my memories what it was like to eat an avocado. And so perhaps the thought experiment disintegrates.
It's still a thought experiment for the student before and after.
Sure, right. For the student, it would be. Right. Yes, sir.
You're fascinating talk, and I want to pick out the phrase towards the end that you are exploring the limits.
Mm-hmm.
Because that does seem to me that I agree with the what if framework you were setting out, but there's still a question, what are you exploring the limits of?
Mm-hmm.
And you have this phrase about experiences and principles. I think experiences may be part of the material relevant, but principles seems to me nearer what you're exploring the limits of in mm-hmm. your legal case, but also in philosophical cases. And another way of putting that, which seems to me more general, well, principle sounds a bit ethical or, but a broader term would be that you're exploring the limits of concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a pretty good description of what thought experiments are for. And as you said, they are a kind of extension or systematization of philosophical activity rather than more generally an intellectual activity.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in that point, then I use experiences and principles, that might be an area I need to work on a little bit, because what I'm really trying to get to, and perhaps those aren't the right terms yet, is that we have to work with the stuff we already have. We can't work with new stuff, excepting, of course, that perhaps we have some new assumed premises or data that I've never experienced before, but we can't work with things we don't have or we've never experienced.
Yes, your definition of a thought experiment, you consider an imaginary case, it struck me as very broad, and it didn't include the concept of hypothesis. Mm-hmm. If we take a physical experiment, it's designed in order to test the hypothesis, and if it's well designed, it can falsify the hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And now, those concepts of hypothesis, testing, falsification, didn't seem to come over into your definition. If we take your example of an avocado and banana sandwich as a thought experiment, it's hard to conceive of a hypothesis that might test, or whether it could, having tested it, falsify the original hypothesis. Should this concept of a hypothesis and testing be introduced into the concept of what makes up a thought experiment?
Mm-hmm. I suppose Popper would say yes, right? I guess, but That's a good question. I don't have an answer right now. I do know that in some experiments, and in my area of law that I work in, I work a lot in clinical research, and the laws associated with clinical research, at least in my specialty. And there are some times where the hypothesis is very thin as to, when you do the clinical research. You give drug X to a person and you see what happens. You think you might know what happens, but you're really seeing what happens and see if there are side effects and what are the side effects. Collect that information so that you can move on to phase two to try and test whether the drug has some efficacy. Ultimately, you're thinking the drug might have some efficacy. So I guess I want to think a little bit more about that, because some experiments, it seems to me, are done simply to see what happens. And so likewise with thought experiments, sometimes I think we think through them just to see what happens when we think through them.
Okay. Yes. That should be the last question. Sure. Thank you very much, Ryan. That was the most important.